I should back up a little bit before I go any further and say that in December of 41 is my when I met my bride. We weren't married until February the 27th, 1943. And this was the year that the summer of 43 is when we did all the freighting to Galena, and also building the and the Eielson Air Force Base, or 20 mile 26, as that was in 1942. But kind of an interesting experience. I had a kind of a unique position with the Army Engineers. I was only a private, and soon became corporal. But I had a powerful paper in my back pocket always that indicated that I could get rid of any of the personnel at the 26 mile base that weren't qualified to handle their job. So there was a first lieutenant out there that had no experience on construction and wasn't qualified to perform the duties that he was supposed to do. So I wrote a letter to my commanding officer at Ladfield, and that suggested that this particular lieutenant be fired or transferred or whatever he wanted to do with him, but at least get him out of his position. Then a couple of weeks went by, and this lieutenant came into my office at Ladfield and slammed down a piece of paper on my desk and says, "Corporal, did you write this letter?" And I said, "Yes, sir." Well, he says, "You know," he says, "that everything you said in this letter was true. But the only thing I regret about it was that I'm being sent to the Aleutian Islands." And on his way out of the door, he turned around and asked me if I'd stand up and shake hands. So I did, and he says, "Corporal," he says, "I never expect to be fired by a corporal again." So that was my first experience in discharging a superior officer, which was kind of a unique experience for an enlisted man. So after that, I was sent to Nome in the military, and then I finally ended up in Anchorage in what they call the Mainland Division of the Army Engineers in Anchorage, and that was in 1945. I was down there for 10 months, and my wife joined me down there for 9 of those 10 months, and tour of duty there down there was mainly doing minor construction and of various runways down at in the Aleutian Islands. I guess I got to most of the stations out there, but it was only for a week or less duty, and it was mostly on repair or repair of airports along the route. And so I was discharged in February of 1946, and they asked me to stay on in my military position for 2 more months, which I did as a civilian. And then in April of 46, I was discharged completely, or let go completely, and I was free to come back to Fairbanks and And we started over again within a week or so after we got back to Fairbanks. We had purchased a house and we'd moved in, and I found a job working for a mining company up in the Keokuk River. And so I slept in the house for less than a week and headed out, and I never saw the house again until 3 or 4 months later. But that was in the fall of the summer of 46. And then following my profession in 47, 48, 49, and 50, I was up in the Kobuk River doing exploration work for a company referred to as the Halkalikon Mines Incorporated. And 47, 48, and 49 were spent up on mostly in the Salmon River in very remote locations. All our freight had to be dropped by air or freighted by dog team, and that's my and a lot of experiences running dogs in those years. We had freighting teams of 110, 120 dogs all in one tow line, with pulling three or four sleds at a time, loaded with fuel oil and drilling equipment. And we had three drills going around the clock for months in the summertime until the dead of winter. But all our supplies had to be come in the spring of the year, like I said, either by airplane or by dog team. And most of our freighting was out of Kiana, which is about 100 miles from our destination. And so in the summertime, we could get airdrops for our food that we needed, like fresh material, fresh stuff, and meat and things like that. We could we'd have a flyover once a week or so, and they'd push whatever we ordered out of the plane. We had a radio contact with people in Kotzebue and Kiana and any place else we wanted to talk to, so we were not isolated in that respect. But we couldn't get any mail out unless we walked it out. So once a year, we'd be writing letters in March, April, May, June, July, and then in August, or in July sometime, we'd have a man from Kiana walk in with his dog to carry our mail out. And so our wives would get a mail once during the summer, and which was however, we could get mail once a week from them, but they were kind of on the short end of it. But this mail carrier, he was a funny guy, Eskimo, a real wonderful fellow, but an old-timer that remembered the wars between the whites and the Indians, and between the Indian tribes, and he used to fire a shot on top of the mountain that faced the camp before he would come down into the valley where we were located. And one time I asked him, I says, "How come, Frank, how come you, or Arthur was his name, Arthur Barr, I says, how come you shoot, fire your gun up there in the mountain?" "Well," he says, "I'm trying to scare the Keokukers out of the valley." And this was in the Kobuk Valley, and years ago there used to be wars between the Keokuk people and the Kobuk people, and the Noatak people. So he still remembered that, although he he was still, it was still fresh enough in his mind that he didn't believe anything like that, but he was still a little bit squeamish, and he figured if he fired the shot up on top of the mountain that the spirits or enemy would disappear by the time he got down. But he'd come down and rest up 2 or 3 days, and finally on the night before the morning that he'd leave, he'd have all this stack of mail that we were sending out. And he'd lift each letter individually, one letter in one hand and one on the other, and he'd decide in his own mind which was the lighter. He'd put the lighter in his pack and the heavier one in his dog's pack. And that continued for hours until he got this whole parcel of mail separated according to weight. And the next morning he'd put all the letters in the small, and that weighed the least, in his pack, and all the letters that weighed the most in the dog's pack. And it took him two nights and 3 days to walk out. But he never lost a letter, never, and the pouches that the dog weighed wore were waterproof, so they could wade streams, and we never lost any mail. But it was quite of a experience to watch him sort and deliver his parcel of mail. I'd also add that this happened in 1948, the second year I was up there, and that was the year my youngest son was born. And he was born on June the 2nd. And it was, for some reason or other, we had radio trouble. It was, he was 3 weeks old before I found out that he was born. And he was over 3 months old before I saw him. And that was also the year that we were able to hire graduates from the University of Alaska, so I took in four of the 1948 graduates, the School of Mining Mineral Engineering, in with me that year. And so four of them got their start in that Upper Kobuk. As far as I know, there's only one of those four that are still alive, and that is he is Nick Lean, who lives in Cooper's Landing now and retired from the Territorial or State Highway Commission. And so I was up, we were up prospecting 47, 48, and 49. In 1950, I operated dredge for the same company on Clary Creek, which was only 17 miles from Kiana. And Kiana is a native village on the Kobuk River, about 110 miles upriver from Kotzebue. We operated this dredge in 1950. So I didn't see the Kobuk River again until 1961, 62, and 63. I operated the same dredge myself. I took a lease on the dredge and operated it for 3 years on my own. So I'm now back up to 50, 51, 52, and 53. I was a superintendent engineer at Livengood for Callahan Zinc Lead Company under a well-known mining engineer by the name of Bruce Thomas. And that was 50. 51, 52, and 53, and we were the last people to operate the dredge at Livengood Creek. At that time, we found out that the bedrock was so uneven that and a dredge was not capable of cleaning bedrock on uneven, where bedrock raises 10, 15 feet and then drops 10, 15 feet. That is to actually make an efficient operation with a dredge, bedrock has to be pretty flat. And so the dredge was dismantled in 53 and brought into Fairbanks, and in 54 it was taken down the Tananaw River and down the Yukon and up the Koyukuk and put on the FE company ground in the Hogatsa River, or the Hog, referred to locally as the Hog River, and that's where it is today.
You did some rather unique things with gold at Livengood. Your wife is saying that you made bricks, bars of with the gold.
Yeah.
What does that entail?
Well, the yes, it was the policy of the company to not ship anything except bar gold, and so that required that all the gold in the sluice boxes and the tables were cut in mercury, and then of course in order to make a bar of gold, the mercury containing the gold had to be refined, or the retarded. The amalgam had to be retarded. Amalgam is a combination of gold and mercury, so that combination had to be put in a iron pot, sealed tightly, and heat put under the bowl, and from the top of the cap of the bowl was a tube that led into a cooling coil, and as the pot heated up, the mercury would come off as a steam, as a vapor, and hit the coils, coal coils, and run off as a liquid. So it was a kind of a distilling proposition that salvaged all the quicksilver that was put on the gold, so it was used over and over and over again. And then after the gold that remained in the pot after the quicksilver was volatilized off was taken out, that is what they refer to as sponge. And so that's put in a graphite crucible along with some borax glass and sodium carbonate and nitre, and put in another furnace and heated to 1800 degrees or more, and all the impurities except such as iron particles and silica and everything that comes along with the gold that isn't gold is what they call the fluxed off. That is, the borax glass and the sodium carbonate and the nitre formed a film on top of the gold, and which caught all the impurities. The gold would remain at the bottom of the graphite crucible, and so when that was you'd use a spoon to test the porridge, and when it was the right consistency, then you'd carefully upend the graphite crucible into a iron mold and then let that mixture cool, and about half your iron mold would be would be slag, and the other half would be the gold bar. And you'd hit it with a hammer and so forth, and your slag would drop off containing your impurities, and your gold bar would be remaining there. And that was stamped and dated and sent to the bank.
So the slag would be on the outside of the gold?
So yes.
Cracking the mold to get to the what's inside?
So well, it wouldn't be on the inside, it would be in the bottom. Gold weighs 19, 18 specific gravity, and everything else weighs much less.
So, oh, I see. So it'd be a layered effect.
It'd be a layered effect. The slag would be on top, and then the gold. Mm-hmm. And these, we'd run them in $20,000, $30,000 bars or whatever was required at the time.
Pretty heavy gold brick.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you were at least closer to home when you got to Livengood.
Yeah, that was much nearer. As we called it an 80-mile trip at that time, and of course there wasn't any pavement. So some of those trips were pretty hazardous. Many times I spent 4 and 5 and 6 hours on the 2-hour trip because of glaciers and soft roads and so forth. But at the time we thought that's the way life was, so we didn't know the difference. Ignorance is bliss. But so that was the end of my Livengood experience, and from there we went to, I guess in 19, then I did a lot of consulting work in between here for the Bering River coal field, and I started a company in 1956 by the name of Exploration Services, and also in 54 I did some work for Usabelli Coal, and I worked for them off and on until 1965, about in the summertime. And when I wasn't down there, I was on various consulting jobs. I spent 3 summers in the Bering River coal field and did a lot of work in looking, doing geological work in the out on the Aleutian Islands and Herendeen Bay area and in the Matanuska Valley area, and a little bit up on the North Slope, but not much, all on coal. Then, like I say, in 61, 62, and 63, I run that dredge, my own dredge, up in the Kobuk. And that was in the summertime, but I was either superintendent or engineer at the coal mine in between in the wintertime. In 1964, I had a horrible experience at the coal mine. That was the year that Amo Usabelli was killed. He was killed on Good Friday, the day of the earthquake, and I think that was March the 27th. And that happened to be a terrible snowy day. He, Amo, had come in from Seattle, or I should say, maybe I never mentioned it before, but Amo was the founder and original owner of the Usabelli coal mine. He started the coal mine in 1943 during the war and built it up to a multi-million dollar company. And in this winter of 64, winter of 63, 64, he took a vacation outside, and in March, I think it was the same day, the day before, he came in the camp, and the next afternoon he said, well, I'm going to go up in the pit and see how things are doing up there. And his hearing wasn't too good, and he had a heavy jacket on with a hood over up over his head, and he met a scraper, a carryall scraper, loaded with rock from the pit, waste rock, and he saw it coming up the hill, and so he stepped off the side to give it clearance, and instead of turning around and seeing that that carryall scraper was far enough away, before he stepped back in the path, he stepped in as soon as it passed, and that was a disaster, because a few feet further on, the operator of the scraper missed a gear and downshifting, and the scraper rolled back about 15-20 feet and crushed Emil, crushed the life out of Emil. And then an hour or so later, his wife flew into camp, and as if I didn't have enough trouble trying to arrange for the coroner and the police and so forth to come out for various necessary inspections, she happened to come out, and she wanted to see the body, and I said, "No, Esther," I says, "I'd rather you not see him, I'd rather you remember him the way he was." And she says, "Does he look that terrible?" And I said, "Yes." And she says, "Okay, I'll take your word, and I won't insist on seeing him." So that little episode was over with. So I finally got her and Emil and the police and coroner back to Fairbanks, and about 5 o'clock that evening, everything had to be done by plane. And it was, of course, a windy, dirty day, and there was several approaches to the runway, all of them terribly hazardous, but all landings and takeoffs were completed. So any good landing and takeoff is a success, regardless of how bad they are. So I was in Fairbanks about 5 o'clock, and so the manager of Usabelli at that time was a fellow by the name of Bill Wagaman, who happened to be in Tokyo on a Chamber of Commerce promotion deal of some sort. And so I called him up, and I talked to him for about a half hour that day. A half hour from 5 to 5:30, and all of a sudden I was cut off from the telephone, for no reason at all. I was sitting there in the Usabelli office on Illinois Street here in Fairbanks, and wondering what I should do. But I decided about then that, well, I'd given Bill all the information that he needed, and if he wanted more information, he could get hold of me. And all, then the street began to buckle, and Illinois Street, I looked out of the window, and I could see it going up and down and up and down as I looked down the street. Telephone poles were swaying from side to side, so I knew that there was a terrific earthquake in progress. So, well, we all thought that at the time it was local. And then we tried to reach Anchorage, and we couldn't get Anchorage. So it was two or three hours after that before the ham radios around town were our first inkling that Anchorage was destroyed. And I always will believe that the reason I was cut off was that the cable between Anchorage and Tokyo was severed out around the Aleutian Islands someplace. The telephone sounded like a roar that you'd get from holding a clam up against your ear. That's what it sounded like. So this brings me up to 1965 or 64, and that's, and I left usability in 65. That's 1965 is when Joe Usabelli Jr. took over as manager. And that was the year that Earl Beislein asked me to come in and teach the new mineral and petroleum technology program that the university was beginning, and which was supposed to teach the natives in Alaska something about the mineral industry to qualify them for jobs in the field. So I was with that program from 65 to 75, and a lot of my students are still in their field, in various places. Some of them are still, I think, up in the Red Dog area, and I know that quite a few of them are still with the oil companies. Some of them are in Cook Inlet, some of them are on the North Slope, and some of them even turned out to be preachers. And I asked one of them why. He became a preacher. I says, you never gave me the impression that you were thinking along those lines, and wondering, I was just curious to know why you took up that profession. Well, he says, I listened to you preach for 2 years, and he says, I thought I'd see what preaching was all about. So that was his answer to my question. But anyway, it did give a lot of students a chance, even though that many of them didn't go into the mineral field. They did get jobs various places. Like I said, there was two preachers came out of it, and there was two or three that went in the state police and around the state. In fact, one time, I don't remember it was, in 83 or 84, a police car came up behind me on the state highway, with a siren going, and I looked at my speedometer, and I thought, I didn't do anything wrong. I was under the speed limit, and there wasn't any traffic on the road, but this siren was coming down, blasting, and so I pulled over, and this police car come up alongside of me, and there was one of my students with a good big grin on his face, and he says, I thought I'd scare you a little bit. So we had a good visit, and he went about his business, and so did I. But anyway, that was one of the little happenstances of the crew. I'm pretty proud of some of those people. I still get calls from people that went to my class or graduated or still in business. Then after 1975, I was able to retire at that time, so I was 60 years old at that time, and I was able to retire, so I got a retirement, a 13-year retirement from the university and from the 3 years of military. They combined the two, so I have a 13-year retirement, state retirement. But since 75, starting in 74, I represented a mining company out in the Chestachina area, which is southeast of Fairbanks. And I represented them from 74 to 1981. And that was a big experience. We went through all the operations out there, did a huge drilling program. It involved 5 or 6 drills. And then the price of gold was too low to be economic, for that particular operation to be economic, so they set it on the back burner for 2 years until the price of gold started to come up. And then it was in 79 when the price of gold became economic, so I designed a 5-section sluice box that that I had been planning for several years, and this eliminated any downtime as far as cleanups was concerned, because I had a capacity in the box to handle all the throughput from the screens and washing plant in 4 sections. So the 5th section was they were all built and so that I could close off one and open the other gates, and it was very versatile. So when it came time to clean up, I'd open the sluice that was had been cleaned up, and clean up one section, and then I'd close that and open another one, and so forth and so on. So I never had any downtime due to cleanups. And I noticed since then that there's quite a few 3 and 4 and 5 section boxes around the country today, all because of the first one that was started at that time. In 1971, I started I was partner of 4 people in starting another company called Resource Associates of Alaska, and it was built into a multi-million-dollar company and sold to NERCO, a company incorporated of Portland, in 1981. And since then, I've been associated with placer mining up in the Circle Country for several years for outfit referred to as GHD, and then we moved from the Circle area to the Seward Peninsula area around Candle on the north side of Seward Peninsula, and we were there for 3 years, and then we moved to Tofte area out of Manly Hot Springs, and we were there for about 4 years. And we closed down that operation this past year.
So you've really seen a good part of the state with all your mining jobs, and certainly span many, many years.
Yes, well, that's my whole profession. I mean, I'm one of the few mining engineers that didn't do anything else. Most of us had graduated. I was in the graduation class of 30 students, and most of them, I'd say 10 of those 30 students were in mining engineering, and most of those 10 graduates in mining never followed their profession. They had to take up civil engineering or go into other professions, but I was one of the few that stuck with it, much to the sadness, I think, of my family. I had a terrible rating at one time of 80-90% absenteeism from home, and I don't really know why or understand how my family ever stayed together, but due to my little lady, I guess I have to thank her for that.
So, in your retirement years, you sound like you're as busy as always.
Well,
but you've also been involved with volunteer work and Pioneers of Alaska. You were past grand president of the Pioneers of Alaska this past year.
Yes.
So what all did that entail? More traveling, I bet.
Yes, I was past grand president, or I am past grand, but last year I was grand president, and that entailed traveling all over the state. The Pioneers number about 8,000 in the state, and each town has a igloo and an auxiliary. I mean, there are 17 auxiliaries and igloos in the state. And so I had to visit each one, which was, and install all the new officers, which was a mighty thrill. And as much as I was born and raised in the state, I know people in every town and every place.
How do you do